Russian President Vladimir Putin says the U.S. and NATO's responses to Moscow's security demands failed to address its principal concerns. Iran says reaching a sustainable deal on the revival of the JCPOA requires practical and verifiable measures by the U.S. And Germany's health minister warns that the country's daily COVID cases could soon double to 400,000. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, the Russian president says the United States and NATO have failed to address Moscow's main security concerns in their responses to its demands. Vladimir Putin made the remarks in a phone call with his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron. He said Russia's concerns include NATO's eastward expansion and the deployment of strike weapon systems near the country's borders. Putin said Russia would closely study the responses and then decide on further action. Tensions have been rising between Moscow and the West in recent weeks over Ukraine. Russia wants binding guarantees against its Western neighbor joining NATO. In turn, the U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of planning an imminent invasion of Ukraine, an accusation Moscow denies.
If it depends on Russia, there will be no war. We do not want wars. But neither will we allow for our interest to be blatantly violated, for our interest to be ignored.
Sergei Lavrov said Russia will take action if attempts to negotiate security guarantees in Europe fail. He said the response could come in any form. Russia, the U.S., and NATO have held several rounds of talks in an attempt to de-escalate tensions. The diplomatic efforts have so far failed to produce a breakthrough, but the two sides have agreed to hold more negotiations. Iran says it has a serious will to reach, in the shortest possible time, a good agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The comment was made by the Iranian foreign minister who spoke with UN Chief Antonio Guterres on the phone. Hossein Amir Abdollahian described as positive the process of the ongoing talks in Vienna on the JCPOA revival talks and the removal of sanctions. He pointed out to a lack of trust in the U.S., saying a reliable and lasting agreement requires practical, tangible, and verifiable measures by the West and Washington. Guterres, on his part, welcomed any progress in the Vienna negotiations, which are underway between Iran and the remaining JCPOA signatories. The U.S. is taking part in the talks indirectly because it withdrew from the 2015 deal and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Well, the eighth round of the Vienna talks is taking a break. EU coordinator says the negotiators are heading back to their capitals for consultations and instructions and will come back next week. Our correspondent Homolizzi says the U.S. must now decide if it's willing to meet Iran's demand and remove all its sanctions.
We also had remarks in the news coming from a top White House official, the Middle East coordinator, saying in one interview that he was familiar, of course, with the process of the talks with the indirect involvement of the U.S., and he said that there is a chance for a deal to be reached, but also there's a chance that there will not be a deal and that the Americans are prepared for both scenarios, although he also said we are in the ballpark of a possible deal. So there is a bit of vagueness there for maybe those listening from the outside. Is there going to be a deal? Is there not going to be a deal? When we talk to sources close to the Iranian side, they tell us that this is because the talks are now at a very advanced stage. Most of the technical or legal work or the drafting has already been done by the experts. What's required now, these sources say, is the political, important political decisions that need to be made. Once those decisions are made at the higher levels, then things can move on pretty quickly. Because now the decision has to be made, they say, by the Americans. Are they going to lift the sanctions that need to be lifted, that Iran believes need to be lifted, not just the JCPOA-related sanctions, but those that have been imposed under the Trump administration, which Iran believes are in fact related to the implementation of the JCPOA? Will the U.S. be willing to give guarantees that it will not withdraw again, that it will not reimpose sanctions? And can these sanctions removal attempts be verified? So these are the questions that require political decisions. Also, sources close to the talks have been saying that there have also been demands that Iran deems unacceptable when it comes to its research and development activities that Iran is not going to accept. So we'll have to see if these important decisions are made and if the sides will be able to reach a conclusion.
Iran calls for the complete withdrawal of occupying foreign forces from Syria. Iran's deputy UN envoy blames a recent terrorist attack in Syria on, quote, continued illegal occupation of parts of the country by foreign forces, including the U.S. Zahra Ershadi says the attack showed that foreign-backed terrorists remain a real threat to regional security and stability. She was addressing a UN Security Council's meeting on last week's attack on a prison in the city of Hasaka by Daesh that left dozens dead. Ershadi said foreign forces and their allies have failed to restore security and order in the occupied areas. She noted that the free movements of terrorists in areas under the control of occupying foreign forces in Syria and Iraq, as well as their transfer to other countries, threaten regional and international peace and security. Northwestern Syria has been the scene of clashes between the Daesh terrorist group and U.S.-backed militants guarding a prison in Hasaka. Damascus says the whole episode is an American scenario.
This is Syria's northeastern city of Hasaka. It is located in a resource-rich part of Syria. The city is not fully controlled by the Syrian government. U.S. troops and their allied Kurdish militants are in control in many key areas here. Hasaka has been the scene of fierce clashes between Daesh terrorists and members of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces over the past week. Chaotic scenes first erupted on January 20th when a large group of Daesh terrorists launched a surprise assault on the Gueran prison in Hasaka. They were trying to help thousands of their comrades to escape from the prison. Daesh terrorists use explosive-laden cars to force their way into the prison, triggering a major jailbreak. They also seized weapons and took over several cell blocks. Following days of battles and many American airstrikes, Kurdish militants said they managed to fully recapture the detention facility after the assailants inside the prison gave up. The brazen assault was the latest reminder of increasing Daesh activities in Syria. When this latest episode in Hasaka was over, the Syrian government reacted to the development. Damascus says what happened in Hasaka this week was in line with American efforts to justify its military presence in different parts of Syria.
The U.S. props up or has some sort of involvement with these terrorist groups, such as the case with Daesh, and then in the same hand wants to say we're going to move in or remain in this country to snuff out this terrorism threat, when I mean that's not really what it's about. The United States just wants to have the appearance of being concerned about stopping terrorism, but in reality it seems like the U.S. is the one who's the most prominent in propping them up.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Bassam Sabbal, said the U.S. is behind the deadly clashes in the northeastern province of Hasaka. Speaking at a U.N. Security Council session on Wednesday, he warned that Washington is seeking to revive the Daesh terror group to justify its occupation of resource-rich parts of Syria.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations stressed that the recent events in Hasaka require the UN Security Council to act. Sabah called on the Council to work toward putting an end to the presence of U.S. forces in northeastern Syria and the southern Al-Tanf region. He also demanded the U.S. halt its support for the Kurdish-led SDF and terrorist groups and its plunder of Syria's natural resources and assets. Sabbah echoed comments by Syria's president's political and media advisor, Butina Shaban. She said in December that the U.S., under the guise of its anti-terrorism mission, intervened in Syria, occupied parts of the country, and plundered its resources like oil and natural gas. When Daesh began seizing large parts of Iraq and Syria in 2014, the U.S. was widely accused of involvement in the creation of the terrorist group. Some even inside the United States, like former President Donald Trump, said that the group was created by the United States. Before coming into office, U.S. President Joe Biden pledged to end America's quote-unquote forever wars. But there are no signs that America intends to pull out the hundreds of its forces in northern Syria who were deployed there without any mandate from the UN or permission from Damascus.
No, Trump was not really that concerned with bringing peace to the Middle East, and Biden is not that concerned with bringing peace either. It's both of them saw the Middle East as a great geopolitical area to destabilize, to ensure that Russia and China have to clean up the mess or help clean up the mess that the United States created.
U.S. officials with knowledge of the Biden administration's plans say that the U.S. will not be pulling out of northeastern Syria anytime soon.
Thousands of Iranians take to the streets to protest against the recent Saudi-led coalition's massive bombings of Yemeni cities. Demonstrations were held in Tehran and other cities across the country after the weekly Friday prayers. Protesters condemned the killings of Yemeni people and denounced supporters of the Saudi-led coalition, in particular the United States. Iran has called on the United Nations to take immediate action to halt the massacre of defenseless Yemenis by Saudi-led forces. Saudi Arabia and its ally, the United Arab Emirates, have carried out dozens of deadly airstrikes on Yemen this week. In one such attack, more than 90 people were killed when the coalition's warplanes bombed a prison in Saada province. Germany's health minister warns that the country's daily COVID cases could soon hit 400,000 as the highly contagious Omicron variant sweeps across the country.
We have high incidences. That was not surprising. I've already said this here. We expect daily incidences of up to 400,000 cases, but we believe that the number of incidences will then go down again.
Karl Lauterbach, however, said despite the surge in infections, the Omicron wave is under control. Meanwhile, Germany's Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases reported that in just 1 week, nearly 900,000 people contracted the disease, which is equal to 1% of the entire population. On Friday, German authorities reported over 190,000 new daily infections, with a further 170 deaths. This brings the country's total death toll to more than 117,000. Iran is reporting more COVID-19 infections, while the number of fatalities remains relatively low thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. Figures from Iran's health ministry show over 16,000 new cases have been detected in the past day. Also, the virus has claimed the lives of 23 people in the same period. Iran's health minister says a sixth wave of the pandemic has begun in the country as hospitals report increasing numbers of admissions and outpatients due to the highly contagious Omicron variant. Health officials are urging people to get booster jabs. So far, over 16 million Iranians have received a third dose of a COVID vaccine. In total, over 130 million COVID shots have been administered, which covers the majority of the Iranian population. South Korea's COVID cases keep surging, with the country logging yet another record in its daily infections. South Korea posted more than 16,000 new infections for Thursday. That's the highest daily case number there since the start of the pandemic. Daily COVID infections hit record highs on Wednesday and Tuesday, too. They've been rising steadily in the past 2 weeks because of the Omicron variant that's highly contagious. Health authorities in South Korea are now warning that daily caseloads could surge to five-digit figures in the coming weeks. The current pace of the Omicron spread continues. The government has extended restrictions on businesses to contain the virus. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro denounces the opposition for its attempt to recall a referendum against him.
The attempt to reactivate the revocation referendum by the opposition against the president was a major fail. It's stupid, it's childish, and it's part of the attacks the opposition has carried out in Venezuela over the last few years.
Venezuela's National Electoral Council has declared the president's opponents did not collect enough signatures for the vote against him. The bid needed 4.2 million signatures of support to go ahead. but according to the Electoral Council, roughly 42,500 were received. Under Venezuela's constitution, officials who have completed at least half of their term can be removed from office by a vote. President Maduro completed the first 3 years of his second term just earlier this month. The opposition blames him for the existing economic hardships. Maduro says U.S. sanctions, including those on oil, are to blame. Latin America correspondent Camila Escalante joins us now from Cochabamba. Ms. Escalante, welcome to the program. What does this failure by the opposition mean, and what does it stand for right now?
Well, it is a testament of the lack of ability of the different diverse sectors of the opposition to organize. The presidency of Nicolas Maduro, that wasn't shown in the May 2018 presidential elections when he beat three opponents, all of who are very popular within their own bases and their own regions of the country. And so they had their opportunity then. This is what Jorge Rodriguez, the president of the National Assembly, came out and said yesterday after that announcement by the National Electoral Council. He said that these opposition leaders who were promoting this recall referendum weren't even able to get the minimum amount of support for the recall in the states which they govern. The opposition governs about five states in Venezuela currently, and even in those strongholds, they didn't get the minimum number required. On average, these polling stations which were open were receiving something like three signatures per hour, very few in a day, and there were 1,200 CNE-regulated areas or voting stations where people could go and put their signature forward in support of a potential recall referendum, which would take place in the next month or two.
All right, thanks a lot. Camila Escalante joining us from Cochabamba. Elsewhere, the United Nations calls on the world to increase pressure on Myanmar's military to stop the violence against its people and restore civilian rule. The UN Human Rights Chief says the country's people have paid a high price in terms of lives and freedoms lost. Michelle Bachelet says the current crisis was built upon the impunity with which the military leadership waged a campaign of violence against the Rohingya Muslims 4 years ago. Bachelet is calling for an urgent, renewed effort to restore human rights and democracy in Myanmar. She insisted perpetrators of systemic human rights violations and abuses must be held to account. Myanmar's military seized power early last year, ousting the civilian government and arresting its de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. USAID's unpreparedness following the withdrawal reflects long-standing structural issues within the agency and is in line with the chaos that plagued various divisions of the U.S. government, starting with the State Department, to which USAID's work is subordinated, says Alice Sperry, journalist, in an article titled USAID Contractors Denounce Agency's Betrayal of Thousands of Afghans Who Carried Out Its Mission. Stay tuned for more. Last October, the top official at the United States Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, got a call with the agency's contractors in Afghanistan. After the last U.S. troops had left the country following a chaotic and deadly evacuation, USAID encouraged its partners to use remaining program funds to ensure the safety of their staff, including by covering living and evacuation costs. Days later, the agency issued a stop work order instructing contractors to cease all non-humanitarian operations in Afghanistan except for those concerning safety and security, according to an internal memo. "Now Power offered thanks for everyone's hard work. We value you," she told contractors, according to multiple people who were on the call. The contractors, many of whom were still scrambling to help their Afghan colleagues leave the country, had been hoping for more specific guidance. They said they had submitted questions to the agency before the call, asking for instructions on how to pay staff at a time when the country's banking system had collapsed. USAID had prohibited contractors from using informal money transfer systems known as hawalas. It took 2 more months for the agency to authorize them on a case-by-case basis. In December, the agency also authorized the use of foreign currency to pay Afghan staff, a reversal from earlier guidelines. On the call, contractors flooded Power with different versions of the same questions. "She had zero answers," said one, who, like all other contractors interviewed for this article, asked not to be named to discuss internal conversations. "She looked like a deer caught in the headlights. She had no idea what was happening on the ground." Another participant told The Intercept, "We were blindsided by how much the senior level of USAID was unaware of what was going on with tens of thousands of its employees." Many development professionals had welcomed Power's arrival at an agency that they felt was in dire need of reform. A former journalist and United Nations ambassador, she is the highest profile official to ever lead the agency and the first to also sit on the National Security Council. But her failure to answer the contractors' questions was just another disappointment to those who had hoped her background would boost the agency's influence on foreign policy. During the turbulent U.S. withdrawal last August, Power had been uncharacteristically silent. As Politico noted in a profile last fall, she didn't even tweet about it. USAID's unpreparedness following the withdrawal, however, runs much deeper than the person at the helm. It reflects long-standing structural issues within the agency and is in line with the chaos that plagued various divisions of the U.S. government, starting with the State Department, to which USAID's work is subordinated. Unlike the Secretaries of State and Defense, the USAID Administrator is not a cabinet-level position, and development work has long been treated as a tool of diplomacy, serving rather than shaping political priorities. Bill O'Keefe, an Executive Vice President at Catholic Relief Services, a USAID partner, told Intercept, "USAID is a Lilliputian with a bunch of Gullivers running around." For 2 decades, the agency has been the face of the U.S. reconstruction efforts in Afghanistan. To tens of thousands of Afghans employed on USAID projects, it was the agency they had believed in and worked for, often at enormous personal risk, that ultimately betrayed them. Many of the failures that characterized USAID's handling of the withdrawal were consistent with issues that had defined its work in Afghanistan for years. USAID contractors described the agency as an unwieldy apparatus run by bureaucrats who are divorced from the reality on the ground. USAID's staff mostly operates from Washington or from inside the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. The work is outsourced to contractors, who go into the field and hire their own local staff. and is debilitated by unrealistic timelines and wasteful spending imposed by legislators looking to tout quick successes, hardly a sustainable model for development. USAID's Afghan workers were not on calls with power and other agency officials last fall, so it was the contractors who had to report back to them and field countless messages and requests for help from people the agency had effectively abandoned. USAID put everything on us, one contractor said. In emails and recorded calls shared with Intercept, Afghans who worked on USAID projects talked with growing desperation about not having the money to feed their families and about their fears of being targeted for having worked with the U.S. government. In awkward and at times testy exchanges, the contractors, the effective intermediaries between the agency and its workforce, could offer only apologies. One told Afghan staff over and over on one call last fall, "We still don't have any guidance. We have been asking these questions since August. I am just sorry." What can I say to them? That contractor later told Intercept, adding, "We have failed you in every single way." Late last November, USAID informed contractors, many of whom were still struggling to get clarity on logistical questions about payments and evacuations, that they would no longer be allowed to use remaining project funds to help their staff. In a memo first made public by Politico, agency officials cited the continued fluidity of the situation in Afghanistan but gave no further explanation for the sudden reversal. The funds, which had already been allocated to USAID projects meant to run through next spring, were a drop in the bucket for USAID, the contractor said. USAID did not answer questions about how much money was left over, but a contractor estimated it to be in the tens of millions out of an agency budget of $41 billion in 2021. The money that wasn't spent was returned to USAID.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witching!
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
The United States continues to break every record for the COVID-19 pandemic. It keeps breaking its own record of the highest number of daily COVID infections, this time with more than 1,350,000 people testing positive in a single day. Hospitalizations are also breaking U.S.'s previous records as Omicron variant surges throughout the country. This is while the number of COVID deaths in America has already passed 850,000 and is alarmingly rushing towards 1 million victims, making the U.S. the record holder by a large margin of the number of deaths by COVID-19.
Record Breaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People, I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and in this episode, we'll discuss a new COVID-19 surge in America with the Omicron variant, how the government is handling the pandemic, and how Big Pharma is gaining astonishing profits from the suffering of the people. In today's program, we are pleased to have our two guests on our show, Ryan Watson, an activist and member of the Socialist Alternative in Chicago, and Dr. Rick Stagenberg, retired psychiatrist and political activist, joining us out of Oregon.
The United States has shattered its own record of having the most people infected of COVID-19 in a single day. More than 1.35 million people in the U.S. tested positive for COVID-19 amid a surge of infections from the COVID Omicron variant, and despite having been one of the first countries to roll out COVID vaccines, having vaccinated more than 70% of the population and injecting many booster shots.
Health officials describe the situation as near crisis level. Each day this week in LA County, hospitalizations continue to rise. And I talked with the executive director of two clinics in Orange County, where they are seeing an astonishing positivity rate. Another weekend in this winter COVID surge, driven by the spread of the Omicron variant. In LA County this week, on average, the health department reported more than 40,000 new infections each day, and 1,000 more people are in the hospital in the past 7 days.
One person who gets Omicron right now is easily infecting two. And the rate of that speed is so fast, you know, the individual is very contagious 2 days before the onset of symptoms.
The United States has seen more deaths from the pandemic than any other country in the world. More than 850,000 Americans have in fact died so far as a result of this pandemic. This is while one of Joe Biden's main campaign pledges was to fight the pandemic in a smart and effective manner. But now with the new Omicron variant and before with Delta, there's a rise of disappointment among the people with the government's handling of the pandemic.
It's not good. Things had gotten out of control quite some time ago, and we've never really caught up. Now with the latest variant being so contagious and not having peaked yet, we're almost back to where we were at the height of Delta with hospitals filling up. And because it's not quite as bad as virulent, that is, the ICUs are not filling up yet, but they very well could be as this thing peaks out.
Record-breaking number of people are being infected, hospitalized, and quarantined as hospitals and ICUs are once again overloaded, prompting hospital officials to call on staff that have tested positive for COVID-19 to come to work and aid the extreme shortage of health workers at hospitals across the country. As the U.S. COVID death toll comes frighteningly close to 1 million people, the political infighting in the U.S. on just about everything doesn't seem to die down. During a Senate Health Committee meeting, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and a top health advisor to President Joe Biden, was questioned about his financial disclosure. Fauci was visibly frustrated during the questioning, calling the questioning senator a moron.
As the highest paid employee in the entire federal government, yes or no, would you be willing to submit to Congress and the public a financial disclosure that includes your past and current investments? After all, your colleague, Dr. Walensky, and every member of Congress submits a financial disclosure that includes their investments. Where would we find it?
All you have to do is ask for it. You're so misinformed, it's extraordinary.
Well, why am I misinformed? This is a huge issue. Wouldn't you agree with me that you see things before members of Congress would see them, so that there's an air of appearance that maybe some shenanigans are going on? You know, I don't think that's, I assume that that's
Senator,
not the case.
What are you talking
it's
about?
It's not the case.
My financial disclosures are public knowledge and have been so. You are getting amazingly wrong information.
So I cannot find them. Our office cannot find them. Where would they be if they're public knowledge? Where?
It is totally accessible to you if you want it.
For the public. Is it accessible
to the public? to the public.
Great. We look
Senator
forward
Marshall.
To reviewing it.
Totally incorrect.
Well, we look
Marshall,
forward to reviewing it.
Senator Marshall, Dr. Fauci has answered you. It is public information, and he's happy to give it to you if you would ask. Senator Moran.
This is while Big Pharma, especially Pfizer and Moderna, have made billions of dollars in a matter of months from vaccinations. And now Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla, a veterinarian, said those who receive two doses of vaccine are not protected from the Omicron variant and called on people to receive another dose of his company's vaccine, making him and his company that much richer. So why don't these companies make vaccines available to the poor of this world?
Well, put simply, there's not a lot of profit in it. Those countries can't pay for it. The United States will not put up the money, and the United States will not compel them or seriously make attempts to at least persuade them to make those available. I mean, there is some work being done now, belated recognition that this is the case, and it's not going away if we don't get the vaccine to other countries. But I don't see this being on a big enough scale to make a difference.
Now, based on company financial statements, it's estimated that Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna will make pre-tax profits of $34 billion in 2021, which works out as over $1,000 a second, $65,000 a minute, or $93.5 million a day. The monopolies these companies hold have produced five new billionaires throughout the pandemic with a combined net wealth of $35.1 billion. So will Big Pharma ever be held accountable?
I mean, I would like to say yes, but the reality is, what political party could we rely on to actually, hold them accountable? And until we have the level of organization, in our communities, in our states, and in our, in our cities, that can actually put the pressure on Big Pharma. I mean, I think the biggest way that we could see Big Pharma be held accountable is to remove the power from Big Pharmaceutical, to remove the power from the insurance companies, the healthcare insurance companies, and put it into a single payer mode. That struggle is out there, it's available, but unfortunately the progressives that champion healthcare did not take advantage of this healthcare crisis.
Despite receiving public funding of over $8 billion, the three corporations have refused calls to urgently transfer vaccine technology and know-how with capable producers in low and middle-income countries via the World Health Organization, a move that could increase global supply, drive down prices, and save millions of lives. So why aren't they doing it?
Because they don't have to. It's as simple as that. They're in it for money. That's what corporations do. The Supreme Court of the United States has determined that that's all they can do. Otherwise, they're not being... they're violating their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. They exist to make money. It doesn't matter how that affects society or individuals. That's one of the evils of capitalism, at least as it exists.
In Moderna's case, this is despite explicit pressure from the White House and requests from the WHO that the company collaborate in and help accelerate its plan to replicate the Moderna vaccine for wider production at its mRNA hub in South Africa. Albert Bourla, the CEO of Pfizer, described the call to share vaccine recipes dangerous nonsense, while the WHO emergency use approval of the Indian vaccine Covaxin earlier this month is clear evidence that developing countries have the capacity and expertise.
If we know that this is a global crisis, this started in Wuhan, and it's spread, and it spreads through, through individuals coming in contact with each other, and we're not addressing this on an international scale, then if there are lives that are still being taken by this system, by this virus, then it has to fall on the basis of the people who have the ability to vaccinate the entire world or create this vaccine and spread it throughout the entire world. And if they're not utilizing that, then I don't know who else to blame than that. And I think that that goes from Big Pharma all the way up to whatever capitalist governments that are allowing them and not putting pressure on them to create these vaccines that they actually funded for them to give.
Now, while millions of people have lost their lives, these companies have made billions of dollars from vaccines, having sold the majority of doses to rich countries, leaving low-income countries out in the cold. Pfizer and BioNTech have delivered less than 1% of their total vaccine supplies to low-income countries, while Moderna has delivered just 0.2%. Meanwhile, 98% of people in low-income countries have not been fully vaccinated.
Pfizer has delivered around 2 billion shots of its vaccine, but the vast majority have gone to Americans and Europeans. Fed up with the inequality, countries led by India and South Africa are pushing a proposal at the WTO to waive IP rights for COVID vaccines and treatments. But Pfizer execs are now fighting for control of the secret recipe that's raking in a fortune for them.
A new report from Oxfam International indicates that the wealth of the 10 richest men has doubled during the coronavirus pandemic, stoking inequality that contributes to the deaths of at least 21,300 people each day. The report states that millions of people would still be alive today if they had had a vaccine, but they're dead, denied a chance, while big pharmaceutical corporations continue to hold monopoly control of these technologies. How is the economic situation with the pandemic?
We're a debt-driven society, a consumer society. That's what our economy depends on. We don't manufacture anything. It's hard to say which way it's going to go right now, but the Fed just mentioned that they're considering raising the base lending rate, the prime rate, faster than they thought. Again, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds, but they say that it isn't needed anymore to control inflation or to stimulate production, so they're going to raise it to control inflation. Well, that's not strictly true. They weren't doing it to keep inflation rates low as much as they were using the, manipulating for the benefit of people in the derivatives market.
According to a study, the overall deaths by COVID-19 in America of male and female blacks, Latinos, and Native Americans were 2 to 3 times higher than those of white and Asian males and females during the assessed period when population per 100,000 people was accounted for. Now, racial ethnic disparities in COVID-19 risks, hospitalizations, and deaths have been attributed to structural and social determinants of health with established deep roots in racism. So why are minorities in America more affected by the pandemic?
The historical quality of air in these urban communities that are often overwhelmingly black and brown or Native American, and then also the food deserts in those areas, you can kind of see that it's actually the class dynamic is that poor people are being killed. In the early stages, it was because poor people had jobs that you couldn't work from home. They didn't have cars, so they were on buses and trains. Because of the history of U.S., you know, slavery and also Jim Crow and all of those things and the hierarchy that's associated in it to our capitalist system on a racial hierarchy, is that 70% of black and brown folks were being killed by COVID. But it's not inherent to race. It's more inherent to the class that they overwhelmingly represent.
Researchers state that Black and Latino persons are more likely to have occupational exposures to COVID-19 than white persons. They also are more likely to live in multi-generational households and more densely populated neighborhoods and have less access to healthcare and private transportation. Researchers also believe that the Black American hesitancy towards vaccines because of their distrust of the system also made them more vulnerable towards the disease.
African Americans have less access to healthcare. They're less likely to be insured. They're more likely to be in the category of Americans, the 30 million Americans who don't even have health insurance, not in any form, including government-sponsored like Medicare and Medicaid. So they have to go to emergency rooms or whatever. This is not something that's treated at an emergency room. There's been efforts to get them tested at the government expense, but they don't pay for treatments. If they want them to be quarantined, they don't make sure that they've got enough food to eat. There was a one-time allowance for giving all Americans, not just the ones that needed it, money to help them get by. It's not enough. Other countries do way more to make sure that people could afford to take time off work and not spread the virus.
American Indian, Alaska Native Reservation-based communities are also at further risk of infection due to a lack of infrastructure and chronically underfunded healthcare facilities.
Now, the Biden administration took several steps in trying to get this pandemic under control, from vaccines, mandatory masks, to shutting down schools, and recently allocating more funds so the population will be able to take free COVID-19 tests amid a shortage of these tests in the country. These measures were, however, not enough, and federal versus states disputes have added to the ineffectiveness of the federal measures.
The role of the division is the typical divide and conquer that we've always seen. There's the you have the Republicans who, at their own conference, I think that they had a criteria. For example, Fox News had a criteria that you had to have a vaccination to go there. But at the same time, they're putting out this anti-vaccine narrative and like telling people that they need to put it up. This could be reflected on so many different levels. Critical race theory, they're utilizing that. They're using these divisions to amplify themselves and to push for their own gains.
In a blow to the Biden administration, the Supreme Court has stopped a major push by the federal government to boost the nation's COVID-19 vaccination rate, a requirement that employees at large businesses get a vaccine or test regularly and wear a mask on the job. The court's conservative majority concluded the administration overstepped its authority by seeking to impose the Occupational Safety and Health Administration's vaccine or test rule on U.S. businesses with at least 100 employees.
In fairness, it's not just a left-right thing. As I mentioned, there are some very intelligent people who I highly respect who are questioning whether it's even worth getting the jab, as they say. I happen to disagree with them, but then I haven't spent 24 hours a day studying it since this thing started, so it's hard for me to rebut their arguments case by case. But from everything I've read, the risk versus benefits is in favor of getting the vaccination. Now, Trump decided to make this a political issue. Trump and the Republicans decided to make this a political issue, and that led to a large percentage of people who consider themselves more conservative deciding that it wasn't a good idea, that they were being lied to, the vaccine was a hoax, it was no worse than the flu, all of which is nonsense.
And now in response to the court's decision, U.S. President Joe Biden said that he was, quote, disappointed that the Supreme Court has chosen to block common sense life-saving requirements for employees at large businesses that were grounded squarely in both science and the law, unquote. Now, Joe Biden called on businesses to institute their own vaccination requirements, noting that a third of Fortune 100 companies already have done so. So how is the government's handling of the pandemic?
We're seeing a vaccine-only approach, which, because of the distrust amongst many working-class people, of the mishandling from both political parties, we're definitely still seeing the spread. Right now, you're kind of seeing a massive struggle between working people, more explicitly the teachers, high school students, parents, in terms of schools, fighting back against the push to keep them inside their workplaces and inside their schools, despite the fact that the evidence is showing that this is a problem and the spread is large in part due to the schools.
The more vulnerable and poor Americans are hit hardest in the pandemic. They can't afford to stay home or quarantine. Losing even a day of work could put them in a dire situation. This is while even the slightest symptoms could leave them home, because first of all, they don't want to risk infecting other people, but also COVID tests are much more difficult to find.
Biggest problem with the handling from the U.S. is that they're putting the interests of the moneyed interests of business above the lives of the working class. And that they're basically saying work is more important. In fact, many people are making jokes of the CDC here in reference to the fact that they are putting forth, you know, business first policies. You'll see memes that say the CDC says, and, you know, just put out something ridiculous.
The COVID pandemic, it's taken hundreds of thousands of American lives. It's separated families and friends and disrupted social life to a great extent. People's jobs and livelihoods have also been damaged, and many have been left in a state of hopelessness and despair. In these circumstances, the federal government does not seem to be capable of uniting the country to be able to effectively fight a pandemic that seems like it's going to stay for now. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for watching. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next week for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now, you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.